Brooklyn's Radio. In the studio we have Martin Fearn. Hi, Martin.
Hello there.
I'm going to talk about Martin's new book, 50 Scams and Hoaxes. But first of all, what got you into writing? Because your background is actually insurance, isn't it?
Yes, well, I was getting to that point when retirement seemed the sensible way to go, and I was looking for ways to keep what few grey cells I had left occupied. So a couple of years before I retired, I started putting a blog together, and which is still running, and over time realised that A, the material was being well received, and B, that I had enough material to start to pull together some books based on the research that I'd done for the blog.
Now, your first book, I have to be careful about the name here, because it's 50 Clever, and then B-A-S-T-A-R-D-S, so I can't say that word. But this is about some interesting characters, I believe.
Yes, it's about inventors who came a cropper. Most of them were killed by their inventions. So there's 50 of them, and it's a feast of schadenfreude. If you enjoy reading about people's misfortunes, then I'd recommend you to get the book.
I know some researchers try the treatment on themselves and that kind of thing, but it's a bit bad if you end up killing yourself with your own invention.
Well, it is, yes, and some of it was injecting themselves, but or breathing in noxious fumes from experiments, but a number were, one of my favourites was an Arab in the, I think it was the 9th century, who wanted to fly, and he strapped himself with wings and threw himself off the top of a building, and unsurprisingly he didn't survive the exercise. But I also found, I think it was a 12th century monk in England who also did that. He survived, but he blamed his demise to the fact that he didn't have any tail feathers.
Well, yes, it's obvious, isn't it? That's all you need to make it work. What strange people. I suppose they're removing themselves from the gene pool is probably a good idea in some of these cases.
Well, possibly, yes.
Now, your latest book, 50 Scams and Hoaxes. Now, this is described as a light-hearted investigation into some of the worst examples of skullduggery, crackery, and hoaxing from history. And you are going back sort of Elizabethan days and so on for some of these, aren't you? But I guess this is where a lot of this started.
Yes. I think the first thing to say is probably scamming and hoaxing has existed from time immemorial. And I pick out one from the 3rd, 4th century BC, which is an early example of insurance scamming. So what I tried to do was to avoid the obvious examples like the South Sea bubble and the Dutch tulip bubble and the Wall Street crash and those sort of things, which everyone, most people know about, and try and shed some light on some of the lesser known, but equally interesting and perhaps more interesting 18th, 19th century fraudsters and scammers.
And there's always been snake oil salesmen, people with all sorts of claims for their liquids and tinctures and all this kind of stuff. But I find the business ones more interesting. Of course, they go back a long time, fake gold mines and fake gold scams and all that kind of stuff. You cover one of them, don't you?
Yes. There's the underwater gold detector, and this was a box that was put in the ocean, and there was supposedly a magical chemical in it which attracted gold from the bottom of the ocean into the box, and the inventor managed to attract quite considerable investment from jewelers and businessmen in America, but And so they had about 1,000 of these machines on the ocean floor and generating quite a bit of gold. And then all of a sudden it stopped. And the reason it stopped was that the fraudsters had made enough money. As all fraudsters seem to do, they scarpered. How the gold got into the box, one of the two was a diver. And so they bought gold from a jeweller or gold merchant and put gold in the machine. And the investors, who were just interested in getting their dividends and profits from the company, really didn't pay too much attention to what was going on. So inevitably it all ended in disaster, but that was quite an amusing one.
Now you might think that this is going back a long time when people were more gullible then, but it really isn't true, sadly. People fall for all sorts of strange things. There was one that's in the newspaper not long ago. It was called Men in Space Suits. I don't know if you saw this one. It was is in India, and two guys who were wearing spacesuits for the purpose of the scam had claimed they've invented this new machine that was going to be sold to NASA, and it used copper that had been struck by a thunderbolt, which is a bit impossible, struck by a thunderbolt, and enabled it to magnetise rice.
Yeah.
And it was called a rice puller, and they were going to sell it for hundreds of millions of pounds to NASA, and they got investment from all sorts of people, including the guy who brought them down in the end. He'd given them 800,000 quid for this very strange thing. And it showed pictures in the newspapers of them, and the spacesuits were clearly just made of silver foil.
Mm.
But they had, when they travelled around to impress people, they had armed guards with them, and drove in limousines and all this kind of stuff. And it's just something in human beings that makes us want to fall for these games or believe too much.
Well, if you boil it all down, we're all aspirational in some way. So we want to improve our quality of life. We want to increase our wealth. We want to enjoy good health. And where scammers come in, it's the interplay really between avarice and credulity and gullibility. And whilst those traits exist in the human psyche, then there's fertile ground for the scammer to ply. And so I don't think there'll ever be an end to scamming. In some ways it's more difficult because of greater regulatory oversight in advertising and financial products and the like. On the other hand, the internet, for example, opens up a scam, even if only momentarily, to a much wider audience than existed in the 19th and 20th century, when the remit or the ambit of a scam was dictated by the circulation of the periodicals that the scammers chose to use.
The internet certainly does make it easier and cheaper for scammers to operate, yes, on a large scale, doesn't it?
It does, but I think the other side of that particular coin is that they tend to get rumbled more quickly than the good old fashioned scams, if you will, where the spread of information was much slower, and so they had a bit more time to reap the seeds that they'd sown.
Yeah, now they get found out quicker and move on quicker. A lot of the stories in your book, although they're from history, they still apply today because there's modern versions of these scams. I suppose the old chestnut, there's nothing new really, it's just,
yes,
just twists on things. What's one of your favourites from history, you think, that is still used in different ways?
Well, to follow up on that theme, occasionally an email pops up in my inbox, and I'm sure many other people receive similar emails from people you've never heard from, usually of African or similar origin, who claim that they're sitting on a pile of money and would like to expatriate said sum of money. And in order to do so, they need a little bit of seed capital from yourself, together with your bank account details. And that's known as advance fee fraud. And I found an example dating to revolutionary France, so the 1790s, called the Letters of Jerusalem. And these were targeted at royalist sympathisers. And the script of the letter is almost word for word what you get today in the emails. They had to flee Paris because of the activities of the revolutionaries. They hid a casket of jewels or money, and they need a little bit of money to finance their return to unearth the jewels or pot of money. And the character who described this, Eugene Vidocq, who started off as a thief and then became a policeman, which is an interesting twist on gamekeepers and poachers, he claimed that the hit rate was around 20%, so 20% of the people they sent these letters out to responded, and each letter generated between 12 and 15,000 francs, which was a considerable amount of money in those days.
That is incredible, 1 in 5 hit rate, because I mean, I know the figures for emails, people who send out sort of bulk emails, if 3% even open them, then that's considered very successful. Never mind actually reply or send money or anything else.
Yes.
So overall, what would you say are the lessons we can learn from these 50 hoaxes and scams?
Well, I think what I was told as a young boy, if something looks too good to be true, it probably is. And as I say, there is an interplay between our ambitions and credulity and gullibility. And I think if you are presented with an opportunity, you need to take a step back and just consider it and test it. And it's astonishing throughout the book how few people, like your Indian example, where it's patently nonsense, get sucked into it, because it seems never to be repeated opportunity, and if they're getting early and quick, then they're going to make a phenomenal amount of money. And as I say, I think the key lesson is to is if it looks too good to be true, it almost certainly is, and to stand back, take a deep breath, and reconsider the opportunity.
Think before you do something. Don't get caught out.
Yep.
Yeah. So the book is 50 Scams and Hoaxes by Martin Fone, spelled F-O-N-E. Now, how do people get their hands on your book, Martin?
Through the publisher, which is Troubadour, or all good bookshops, and even Amazon. And it's available in paperback and e-book form. As I say, Troubadour, or just Google my name, and it, you should find links to suitable vendors.
Very good. Thank you, Martin. Pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, and it's been a pleasure to come today.
Brooklyn's Radio.